following program is recommended for mature individuals and may contain material unsuitable for morons, cretins, and dishwipes. If you are a moron or a member of the PTL Club, please turn off your radio, because we don't need any more stupid, narrow-minded, pencil-neck geeks who wouldn't know the First Amendment if it came up and bit them on the butt. Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. This is episode 23 of Chat with a Cat. This is being recorded July 8th, 2025 in the real world, which is just after games 1 and 2 of the first round of the 1984 PBSL playoffs, well, NPBSL playoffs. I wanted to start off by getting into the standings, the finish, end of season, teams trending up, teams trending down, looking ahead slightly to the offseason, perhaps. And then we're going to get into, after a break, a look at some of the playoff matchups in particular. There have been some fantastic results already, even though none of the series, I think, is particularly competitive so far. There have been some really good performances, and I wanted to get into that. But I wanted to start with kind of a season review, looking at where we are, how we got here, how teams finished out the season. I did notice, for example, the Bucks decided to bench most of their starting lineup to stay healthy for the playoffs. They had locked up the number one seed in the East for certain, and I think they probably felt pretty good about locking up the number one seed overall. And so that's always a discussion that people have, is do you fight for everything you can get, or once you've got your playoff seeding locked in, do you kind of pack it in and let it ride? And clearly Doug decided to pull back to make sure he had all of his horses healthy for the postseason, which I think is a reasonable path to take. It's kind of interesting, after being on a monster winning clip most of the season, going into the final sim, they were 62-14, and they kind of took their foot off the gas, finished 2-4. But I don't think they really care. They came into the playoffs with pretty much everybody mostly healthy. Terry Tyler and Robert Reed are still out with, not even out, they're day-to-day with broken collarbones and sprained ankles with the first round bye. The Bucks will be 100% healthy the next time they're on the floor, so that's kind of your reward for performing well, running up a big lead early in the season. Is late in the season, you get to rest guys and get them healthy. I have to say, I was surprised at how much the Bulls managed to push the Bucks at the end. The Bulls wound up winning, or Logan rather, wound up winning the GM of the Year award. And I think it's definitely deserved. He was very, very patient. We knew, I think everybody knew, that he was looking for another big to add to his rotation. Going into the trade deadline, he pulled the trigger on Tree Rollins, and I think that really gave him a solid defensive rotation. It's kind of interesting that in the East, the focus at the very top between the Bucks and the Bulls seems to be heavily on defense. Whereas I think for the West, the focus has been a little more on offense. And they say styles make fights. So when we eventually get a finals, if it is the Bucks or the Bulls, as I expect it will be, it will be fascinating to me to see how that defensive philosophy stacks up against an offensive philosophy. If you look at the defensive efficiency ratings on the season, the Bucks were number one at 94.7 points per 100 possessions allowed. The Bulls were number two at 100.5. For reference, the Knicks, Celtics, and Mavericks on the season were worse than that offensively, but that's it. So the defensive efficiency of the Bucks and the Bulls was really on point. The Bucks are in another stratosphere, and the Bulls are a notable step better than the Bucks. And, you know, everybody else is kind of clumped together. I guess there is a big jump with the Spurs and the Suns being awful on defense, but there are not any large jumps like you see between the Suns and the number three Nets, and then the Bucks and the number two, or sorry, the Bulls rather, and the number two, number three Nets, and the Bucks and the number two Bulls. So you got two really, really big jumps there, and that just shows how much focus these teams have put onto the defensive end of the ball. Will that wind up winning a title for either of them? That remains to be seen. The Cavaliers in the Central had a really solid season. They made the playoffs as a four seed. They're currently, and we'll get to this, they're currently matched up against the Nets, probably not having as much success as they would have hoped, but they definitely had a solid season. The Pacers, Pistons kind of fell off at the end. I think probably by the trade deadline, it was clear they weren't going to make the playoffs. It is interesting that we didn't see any team finishing the season on like a 50-game losing sweet as we have seen the last couple of seasons. So that's kind of nice to see, is that teams are starting to try to put together rosters that at least they can build around in the future. And of course the Hawks are in the midst of a rebuilding season. I still come back to my observation going into the trade deadline. I'm not sure, other than sheer inactivity, why the Hawks wouldn't have shopped Dan Roundfield harder. I do think they might have been able to send Roundfield to the Bulls instead of the Bulls getting Rollins, and probably gotten about the same return in picks and young players. I think that would have behooved the Hawks to do, but clearly they had other plans. Also, staying in the East, the Bullets wound up beating the Nets by 3 games for the Atlantic Division title. The Nets started really strong and faded a little bit toward the end of the season, or maybe the Bullets had a rocky start early and then came on strong late. I do remember looking at the Bullets' schedule, and I'm going to go ahead and pull them up again. I remember them having a lot of early road games. Yeah, their road schedule, especially through about December 12th, was much, much heavier than their home schedule. And looking at the back half of their schedule, if you bar the 5-game road trip they closed the season on, from basically the middle of February through the end of April, looks like it was about 2/3 home games. And that's probably where they were able to put on the gas, close the gap, and eventually wind up passing the Nets. The 76ers had another season where, you know, they were okay, a little below average, but nothing great, not awful enough to get a top pick, or at least the odds for a top pick in the lottery. The Knicks are foundering a little bit. The Celtics pushed everything onto Ralph Sampson, and it was all Ralph all the time. And that might be good for picking up Rookie of the Year votes. It's not good for picking up wins. They finished tied for the worst point differential in the league. Which reminds me, going back to my comments earlier about point differential, I wanted to kind of use that to go back and look at teams and see maybe who overperformed and underperformed a little bit. You'll remember that the formula for point differential to wins is basically start with 41 wins, and for every half point of differential positive, add a win. For every half point negative, subtract a win. So starting with the Bucks with a differential of 15.6, we should reasonably expect them to win about 31 games over the 41 mark, which would have put them as a 72-win team. Obviously, they weren't that. They wound up at 64 wins, but as we mentioned, they kind of took their foot off the gas that final sim. And so I think really, had they kept their foot on, they probably wound up 67 wins. Let's say 3 of those 4 games they win. Maybe 2, but 66-67, it's a little bit of underperformance, but what it speaks to is the Bucks are the team to beat in the playoffs. They are the favorites, and I think barring injury, I would expect them to see the title game, and I would expect them to win it. Behind them in the East is the Bulls. They finished with a point differential of 8 Obviously double that to 16 and add it to 41. You're expecting to see them win 57 games. They wound up winning 58, so they're right on schedule there. The Cavaliers finished with a point differential of 1.8. Let's double that to 3.6 and round up to 4. That means they should win about 45 games. They overperformed and got to 49. So even though the Cavaliers finished as your 4 seed ahead of the Nets, maybe there's a little bit of fool's gold there. And if I were the Cavaliers, I would definitely be looking at ways to reinforce my team in the offseason. Not that they're a bad team, but it seems like their peak is going to be first round of the playoffs. And if they want to break through and go deeper, I don't think you can hope that the Bucks or the Bulls or even the Bullets is going to take a step back. And so you've got to figure out a way to improve. Right now they're matched up against the Nets. And, you know, maybe they feel like they, if they had a different matchup, if they got to the third seed, they could match up against the Pistons. But I think the Bucks and the Bulls are going to be atop the division for a while. So that's your either one or two, and your three seed, the Bullets or the Nets, are going to get the other top seed. So the Cavaliers have to try to make market improvements to get out of the 4-5 where they've been the last couple of years, and don't know if they're ready to do that. The Pistons finished at minus 2.6. The Pacers were minus 2.5. Let's call that, when you double it, minus 5. So we would expect them both to be at 36 wins. The Pacers finished at 37, not 36, so darn close. The Pacers finished at 32, so they underperformed a little bit. And I feel like I've been saying this all season, but I felt like the Pacers kind of had a season where they underperformed in general. I was kind of watching them this season, and they did have the Dantley injury, which slowed them down a little bit. He only played 57 games. Maybe that's the explanation for it. I think the more likely explanation, obviously Kareem was out for an extended stretch, is that the Pacers just aren't very deep. They're Jobari Carroll, Adrian Dantley, and maybe Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but we all know Kareem is getting up there in years. He's been in decline for sure the last couple of seasons. The Pacers declined his team option, so it's clear they don't see him as the long-term solution. At 37, you have to think another big hit is coming. You know, he dropped into green this year. Will he be yellow next year? Who knows? So I think the Pacers really need to figure out a way to get younger. Adrian Dantley is coming into his prime. I think he would have been easier to move this season because of his smaller contract and because the Pacers are going to have a lot of cap room this season. Next season, he's up for a max deal. They've already got Jobari Carroll on a max, and then they've got Darryl Walker and Rob Williams, and that's it. So they're going to have to go out and totally retool this roster. Is it time for a reset in Indiana? I don't know. I've mentioned before, most of the time when I'm watching the Pacers, I like their moves, and it makes me question myself a little bit. Do I understand the game as well as I think I do? Because I look at the Pacers and I think, yeah, that's a good move, and yeah, that's a good player, and yeah, that's a good lineup. And then they go and drop a 32-win season on me. So, you know, maybe I don't know them as well as I do, but I think the injuries to Abdul-Jabbar and to Dantley can certainly explain why they maybe fell a little short of expectations. The Hawks finished with negative 9.3 wins. Double that and you get negative 18.6. Let's go up to negative 19. So 41 plus negative 19 is 41 minus 19, which is 22 wins. They overperformed a little bit at 25 wins. So the Hawks are kind of in the same place they've been really since the start of the league. It feels like they're spinning their wheels. It feels like they're looking for their star. I've mentioned before, they do have a lot of young pieces. They've got Kellogg, they've got Elo, they've got Derek Harper, who are all 22, who are all blue potential. It feels like they're all far away from really being ready, except maybe Kellogg. And if Kellogg is the best player on my team, I don't know that I feel great about that. The Hawks will be in line for a high draft pick this season. We'll see how much. I would guess they probably got a top 6 pick, maybe a top 5 pick when everything is said and done. Right now, just eyeballing it, it looks like they're in the number 4 spot. I guess I could pull up the draft preview and confirm. Yeah, they're in the number 4 slot. So they've got as good a chance as any to jump up. I don't think more than two teams jump them. I could see one team jumping them for sure. Maybe two, odds of three teams jumping over them into the top three. Very, very bad. So let's say they're going to be at worst number six. I think that gets them either a purple or Charles Barkley or one of the other two bigs in the persons of Sam Bowie and Kevin Willis. So I think they'll have a chance to add a player next to Dan Rounfield. I'm curious to see how long Rounfield is going to remain relevant and how soon the Hawks move off of him. Obviously, he didn't lead them to greatness this year, and he's got three more years left at a max contract that's going to hamper their ability to try to bring in guys to build around whoever they draft. And the other thing I would be a little bit worried about if I were them is that Jeff Ruland is going to be in line for a payday pretty darn soon. Yeah, not next season, but season after. So this is their season really to strike before they have to start paying guys to build around their young core. It's always the dichotomy, right? You get guys on rookie contracts and they're young and they're cheap and they're good, but very soon they become max players. And if you don't pay them, you're probably going to lose them. So that's something to worry about. Jumping over to the Atlantic, the Bullets finished with a point differential of 4.9, double that to 10. Well, 9.8, well, let's round up to 10. So they should have finished with 51 wins. They finished with 50, close enough. Nets finished with a differential of 3.3, double that to 6.6. So you're looking at 47, 48 wins. They were on 47, right at expectations. 76ers were at minus 5.6 differential, double that to negative 11. That puts them on a 30-win pace. They finished with 32, a little ahead of the pack. The Knicks were at minus 6, double it to negative 12. That puts them on a 29-win pace. They finished with 28, again, close. Celtics were negative 11.4, double that, and you're looking at 22.8. Let's call that 23, so an 18-win pace. They finished with 17, so again, using that point differential formula, it's not perfect, but for almost all of these teams except the Pacers, it's within a game or two of where they finished. So, again, if you want, I think one or two sims is still, the numbers are too small to really get a good look. But once you're three, four, five sims in, the point differential, it's not perfect, but it gives you an indicator of where you're going. I'm going to take a break for a minute before I go out to the West. I think I'm going to try to split this podcast into three roughly equal parts. We'll do East first. Second, we'll do the West year in review. Maybe look at, in the third segment, both awards. I know I've kind of obliquely referred to some of them. And then playoff matchups, including some of the early playoff results. And we can have a way too early overreaction to the first two games of the playoffs. And so with that, I'll take a break, get a drink, and be back in a moment.
No, not the ball player, the attorney at law. Let me ask you a question. Would it be okay if someone did this to you? How about if they did this?
Who are you? What are you doing in my yard?
I fight for your rights as a human being. I've sued over 2,000 canines, and I'm willing to do it for you.
I dropped the kids off at my mother-in-law's house, and her dog stuck its nose in my crotch. Wade Blazingame got me $4,000.
I've been responsible for over 23 dogs put down, and three more are scheduled to die. Dogs don't deserve special treatment. They have to play by the same rules we do.
I was delivering the mail, and this dog had came out of nowhere and barked at me. Wade Blazingame sued them, but we lost. Wayne told me for $50 he'd kill a dog.
I did not tell him that. Look, am I happy that that dog is rotting in hell? Yes. Did I personally inject a steak with poison and feed it to the dog? No. So remember, you wouldn't let a person do this to your yard. So don't let some egg-sucking dog do it. Call me, Wade Blazingame, or my brother, Doug, for a free consultation, and we'll get you justice.
Call Wade Blazingame. He's man's best friend.
All right, before we completely turn the wig-nosy Eye of Sauron away from the east and over to the west, just one quick note here. I mentioned earlier the Bulls won GM of the Year. I think it was deserving. I think there were two major moves this season that were reshaping of the league. The Bulls' pickup of Tre Rollins was one. Obviously, the Magic Johnson trade, which we spent almost an entire pod on, was the other. And you could have said, if you were the Lakers, that you had a case to be GM of the Year after pulling off the Magic Johnson trade. I think that's probably correct, but I think the Rollins trade did more for the Bulls than the Lakers. I think the Lakers were still a playoff team for sure. The Bulls kind of felt like a borderline playoff team before the trade, and this solidified them into a contender. I think you could still make the argument the Lakers are a contender as well. But this speaks to something that that came up a season or two ago in chat. I mentioned that I felt that Darth was, a couple of years ago, the coach of the year, and Doug was the GM of the year. And this came up with some things, you know, well, what about, you know, building last year? And, you know, GM of the year is kind of a one-year award. You know, as an example, the Warriors are still very good this year with the Parrish and Malone duo. But there's no credit given this year for putting them together because the trade that was executed to put them together happened a year ago. One could argue, I suppose, that GM of the Year also should be for keeping a team together that is doing well in spite of other external forces. And that's kind of an interesting one. But it seems to me that usually when we think of GM of the Year, we think of a GM that significantly improved his team's chances as opposed to a GM that maintained his contender's good chances. And it raises the question, you know, is good GMing taking something decent and making it great? Is it taking something bad and making it good? Is it taking something great and not ruining it? I think there's a case to be made for all three, but in general, I think when we think of GM of the Year, we think of a GM that took something middling to decent and made it great, because that's the hardest jump to make. Keeping something great isn't usually hard. You just try not to mess it up very much. Going from bad to good, or at least bad to decent, isn't that hard, because, you know, adding one or two decent pieces can make a really big difference in the world of basketball. It's the jump from decent to good, I think, that is the hardest jump to make. Well, I think I mentioned before, good to great is even harder, but there are very few of those moves out there. I think the Bulls were middling, borderline good before the trade. I think they're great after it. So having said that, let's now swing back over to the West. In the Midwest division, the Kings wound up coming away with the division again. I think the Jazz made it more uncomfortable than Darth would have liked to admit. They finished five games back. The difference in points between them is 2.5. Again, double that, that's a five-game difference. Again, that formula kind of runs right into where we saw both teams finish. The real difference between these teams, as I see it, is on the road. They had identical home records at 31-10. The Kings were a winning team on the road at 23-18. The Jazz were not going to win on the road. They were 18-23. So that's the difference right there, is that five-game swing on the road. But it also tells me that the Kings, and I think I've mentioned this before, are a team that I can view as a title contender. One of my cutoffs for is a team a contender is, do they have a winning road record? So if I look back at the East, let's say, I could say that the Cavaliers, the Bulls, and the Bucks are contenders. I can say the Pulitzer contenders. I wouldn't think of the Nets as a contender. Come back to them in a minute. Pistons are not a contender. In the West, Kings, contender. Jazz, not. Warriors, 26-15 on the road, contender. Blazers, 23-18, contender. Lakers, 23-18, contender. Sonics, 20-21, not a contender. That's one of the things that I look at. And the reason I say that is because even if you're the number one overall seed, it's likely at some point you're going to play a team that is good enough to take a road game from you. It might not happen in the first round, but in the conference finals, you're almost certain to be playing a team that is good enough to take a road game. And if they can take a road game from you, they have home court. If you can't overcome home court advantage, you can't win the series. So the way I think about that is, you know, the Kings are, I think, contenders. Obviously, they won the title last year, and you would say, well, duh, they're contenders. The Kings, to me, took a surprising step back this year compared to last season. I feel like last season they were stronger, and you would think that with the Andrew Toney pickup in particular, they would be a stronger squad. Andrew Toney is excellent. They've still got their core of Nat King and Kaminsky. But for whatever reason, the chemistry just, it's felt a little more off this season. I don't know what that is, and I don't know how they fix it. I know earlier I mentioned the injury to Wes Unseld kind of threw them for a loop. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as I noodle on it. Wes is a player with a high defensive rebounding rating, a high offensive rebounding rating, a high post defense rating, so obviously a defender. Low inside rating, meaning he doesn't demand the ball a lot. That leaves things open for Nat and for Kaminsky and for King and for Toney to take shots. And I mentioned before, it's almost impossible to have five 20-point scorers on a team. There's just not enough shots to go around. And so I have found that in general, most of the teams that I find historically good or historically relevant in the discussion for best team ever have at least one player that you could describe as offensively challenged, but I would describe more as offensively disinterested. And Wes Unseld for the Kings this season was their offensively disinterested player. He wasn't going to take shots away from the rest of the team. And Mark Landsberger kind of fills that same role. He's got similar scores, and he looks like he stepped in for the most part to help fill the breach with Unseld being out. But, these guys aren't commanding a lot of shots, so they let your high-volume scorers, who are usually very efficient and good at drawing fouls, have the floor. I mentioned in particular, it's one of the reasons I wasn't as thrilled with the Vinnie Johnson pickup. And one of the things that I would point to is PER. On the season, Bernard King had a 28 PER, Kaminsky had a 24, Calvin Natt 23.7, Andrew Toney had a 15.4, Wayne Robinson, who actually spent quite a bit of time on the floor, had a 15.1, Vinnie Johnson 14.1. Remember, 15, by definition, the way the formulas work, is average. The guy who spent the most time on the floor other than those guys is Alan Lavelle. If you look at Alan Lavelle's PER, it's a kind of disappointing 12.4. So Johnson and Lavelle almost actively hurt them when they're on the floor. So if I'm the Kings, I don't know what I do with that because they don't have a lot of other good options in the backcourt. Randy Whitman's PER was even lower. The rest of their team are all bigs. It makes me wonder, you know, last season Darth was a fiend on game planning. Does he have the flexibility with this team to game plan that he had with last year's team? I'm not convinced the answer is yes. The Jazz had a good season. It was kind of marred by the end, or at the end rather, with some injuries to Tom Chambers and then Randy Brewer. And then Kiki went down in the playoffs. I don't think they're going to be able to make it out of the first round simply because their two biggest guns in Chambers and Kiki are out with injury. So a great season with the Jazz kind of ending in heartbreak. I think the Nuggets surprised me a little bit. They wound up winning 39 games. I felt after a season when they sold off Alex English and Dan Roundfield, I didn't expect them to bounce back quite this quickly. Obviously, the Drexler pickup in the draft was better than I thought it was. I didn't think that Drexler would be able to average 18 points a game. Looking over the way things wound up for the Nuggets, it's interesting that they almost morphed into the Trailblazers light in terms of team scoring balance. Louis Orr averaged 21.8 points. Clyde Drexler averaged 18.1. Michael Brooks, 14.7. Roy Sparrow, 13.9. Michael Wiley, 13.4. Lonnie Shelton, 13.0. Sly Williams, 11.1. So you've got seven players in double digits. No superstars on the Nuggets, but we all know Drexler, given time, should be able to grow into that. And Louis Orr, after being mocked for his signing with the Bucks, has actually turned into a very good player. I know Doug is going to, you know, break his arm patting himself on the back for that. And if you look at Orr, he wound up using a huge amount of possessions. You know, his usage rate wound up being 28, which is high on the team. Drexler's usage rate was only 21. I think as the team transitions from having Orr do less and to having Drexler do more, they've got a bright future ahead of them. They do probably need a big, and that raises the question, where are they going to get it? They have the Trailblazers, Kings, and Bullets picks in this draft, and I mentioned in the town hall, I thought the Blazers might be a team to try to move up. I'm not convinced that those draft picks give them enough trading capital to move up high enough to get a great young player in the front court. So I almost wonder if they would be better served looking, you know, to call out a team in particular, to the Hawks, and maybe offering those for Dan Roundfield. You know, they're cost controlled on Louis Orr and Drexler for the next couple of seasons. Roundfield would give them a solid building block in the middle to build around. Those picks are going to be late, and it's going to be a while before they become useful. But clearly the Nuggets have some idea of where they're going. The Rockets feel like they just kind of foundered for another season at 32-50. The Mavericks at 28-24 showed a pulse, which is more than I thought they showed last year. The Spurs. I'm not sure, honestly, what to make of the Spurs. And the reason I say that is I do think that they used the excuse of an early injury to Mark Aguirre to hold him out way longer than they needed to. He only played half the season. Maybe by that point it was clear to them that they were in a bit of a lost season, but I still would have liked to see more of an effort there. Although, you know, again, I can see what they're trying to do. It seems like they're trying to tank and build up a war chest of good players. The concern I would have with that is if they strike out in free agency this season, next season they have to pay Isaiah, they have to pay Aguirre, they have to pay Eddie A. Johnson. All three of those players are probably max players, so the Spurs are running out of time where they can win on the cheap. They're going to have to start paying their guys, and if you haven't put the infrastructure in place around your core by that time, it's very hard to go get it later. So I would expect the Spurs to be extremely aggressive in free agency this offseason. Moving on to the Pacific, the Warriors finished up another excellent season. They're the number one seed in the West with a 63-win total behind Robert Parrish and Moses Malone. Obviously, Parrish had a little bit of time off due to injury this year, but still, the Warriors had the strength and power to roll the division. I think the unsung hero on the Warriors, and I'm not just saying this because he's a former Trailblazer, was David Thompson, their offseason pickup. Thompson averaged 21 points a game for them this year while starting 82 games at the shooting guard, shooting 52% from the floor. Came in at almost $700,000 in salary. Obviously, he's been doing that for the Blazers the last couple of years. It's kind of disappointing to see him doing it with the Warriors, but I won't say it's surprising. He's always been a pretty efficient scorer, gets to the line a lot, and gives you some surprising shot blocking from that guard position. We'll be interested to see how deep they go in the playoffs. Their main pieces are Malone, Thompson, Parrish. Kelvin Ramsey got injured late. He'll be back. James Bailey, I think, is a little bit miscast at small forward. I like him better at power forward. Kenny Carr has been getting some runs. So the Warriors are deep. They're star-studded as ever at top. I think Parrish, as he's 30 years old, and as Malone is 29, they might be slipping a bit. They're certainly not getting better at this point. I don't know that they're getting worse yet. I think the question is, how long are they going to stay good? The Warriors are probably going to need to extend both of them this offseason. They're going to need to try to bring back David Thompson. The scary thing, if I'm a Warriors fan, is that they did not sign Thompson for more than a year, meaning they don't have his bird rights. And if you project out and you project Parrish and Malone both getting maxes, that probably almost caps them out. And so it's going to be very difficult for them to bring back David Thompson. So I wonder if they try to prioritize paying David and hoping he'll sign first. The caveat with that is if Moses and Parrish sign first, they're just not going to be able to afford David. So interesting times coming up for the Warriors. The Blazers had a season where they finished with 56 wins, second place to the Warriors in the Pacific again. It's another team, another season of the Blazers having a bunch of guys averaging in double digits. This time it's only seven, but they have both Lester Connor and Jim Sponarkle averaging 8.5 and 8.9. So again, the Blazers are deep. I think, again, lower ceiling than some of the other teams, but a higher floor. The Lakers. This was the team that could have had the GM of the year votes if things had gone differently. The addition of Magic immediately catapulted them to the lead league in assists. They're playing Magic at power forward. Obviously, they're still built around that core of Wilkes and Free and Davis and Donaldson and Magic. Much like the Spurs, I think I would be very concerned if I were the Lakers as I come into the offseason, because Donaldson probably commands a max. Magic commands a max. World Be Free, they'll probably give him a max. Brad Davis, they'll give him a max. They're already committed to a max to Norm Nixon. They've got Jamal Wilkes getting quite a bit of money on the roster. That's like six maxes. You just don't have the ability to sustain six maxes. They got bird rights on all these guys, so they can bring them back, but the luxury tax payments are going to be absolutely eye-watering if they do that. Maybe they think it's worth it, because I think in their current iteration, they're scary, mostly because of Magic. What I don't think is scary is the fact that Jamal Wilkes is 30, World Be Free is 30. Brad Davis and Norm Nixon are 28, so those two are in their prime. Wilkes and World Be Free are about to start getting old. How long is the Lakers' window realistically? Obviously, Magic's 24. He's not going anywhere. James Donald at Johnson at 26 has a few years. But the Lakers have to be seriously concerned that their talent at the top could start eroding. And so max contracts all the way around may not be the best idea. We'll see what turns they make in the offseason. Going back briefly to the Trailblazers in the offseason, again, I don't like talking about my own team over much. The only player of consequence that's up for free agency is Jim Sponarkle, who was like ninth or tenth man on the bench. So the Trailblazers are set for this season, but they're going to start getting expensive in a couple seasons as well. The Supersonics, they had another winning season. I think, you know, they're excited for that. I think they would like to make some noise in the playoffs. I think because of just how doggone deep the West is, that's going to be very, very tough. I think this is the perfect example of a team that is good and looking for the move that's going to jump them to great. They've had Dennis Johnson out for the past few sims, but that didn't allow them to meaningfully pull away from the Clippers or pull towards the Lakers. They're kind of stuck in the lower half of the playoff rosters where they're at. I would expect them to look to make a move in the offseason. Maybe it involves Michael Thompson. Maybe it involves Dennis Johnson. I don't think both of them may re-sign, but I don't think both of them come back, just because I think that will put the Lakers way higher over the cap long-term than they'd like to be. Or, sorry, not the Lakers, the Sonics. The Clippers, I think they were disappointed by the fact they weren't able to make playoffs. They're an interesting case in terms of point differential record, and they've got a minus 0.9 point diff, which should translate to minus 1.8 games from 41, so about 39 wins. They won 45. The thing that I have been wondering about the Clippers, and I suspect this has to do with something that Raby alluded to in the chat, is maybe he wasn't paying as much attention as he could. The reason I say that is James Edwards only played 21 games on the season. He was hurt early, but he's been back for several sims now, and I was just waiting for the Clippers to plug him in so that they could make their run at the playoffs, and they never did, at the risk of trying to sound annoyed or calling out the Clippers or whatever. Why would you pay James Edwards a max if you're not going to play him, especially on a team that has playoff aspirations? So it's one of the things that I've thought about, that I wonder if, you know, we try or we implement. There is the option to hire a computer coach, and instead of having your computer, or your human rather, set your lineups, you let the computer do it. Is that something we let the Clippers do so they don't have to worry about adjusting lineups? I don't know. And I guess it depends on whether or not the coach you find does a pretty good job of matching players to the style you have in mind. I don't know how that works. I haven't really tested it, but something to keep in the back of the mind for people that aren't going to be on all the time or managing the injuries or remembering when guys come off of IR. Do we need to ask, is it okay to have a computer coach? Then there's the Suns. The Suns crash landed to the bottom of the standings after trading Magic. They have some intriguing pieces going forward in John Bagley, in Ron Brewer, Larry Smith, Eddie L. Johnson. What do they do with that remains to be seen. I think, you know, obviously the Suns were in on the tank fest for this season. They're likely to get a good player. How quickly can they come back in the competitive Pacific? I think if they're able to turn it around quickly, it probably leads toward more teams tanking quickly. If they're down at the bottom of the Pacific for five or six more years, I think it might be a cautionary tale against trading a four-time league MVP. So we'll stop it here. We'll come back and talk a little bit about some of the awards and the playoff matchups, and then we'll start putting the finishing touches on this week's show.
therapy?
No, thanks. Maybe later. Hi, I'm a smoker, and while most airlines are turning away my business, I'm glad there's a new alternative for people like me.
In the event your cigarettes go out, a plastic mask will drop down, dispensing exhaust fumes directly from our engines. Strap it around your face and inhale normally.
Ah, that's good. So listen, if you like to smoke and you gotta fly, go with the airline that's like an ashtray in the sky.
We put the tar in tarmac. We put our heart in your heart attack. It's no joke.
Call your local cardiologist for details.
Okay, we're back for the home stretch, and I promised to go over awards and some early overreactions to playoffs, so we're going to start with the awards. I mentioned earlier in the pod, Logan of the Bulls won GM of the Year. I think Lazy Titan Smash could have had an argument here, but I don't hate the selection of Logan. I think he was patient, he got what he needed, and he's propelled his team to elite status. Magic wins MVP again, no surprise there. Ralph Sampson of the Celtics is the Rookie of the Year. I'm going to come back to this when I talk about the all-rookie teams. I think Ralph Sampson got force-fed a little bit by the Celtics, but there wasn't a more deserving player out there. And this is something I always think about when people say, oh, this player was snubbed or this player should have made it. Tell me who was better, who should have been there instead. And if you can't do that and can't make a compelling case for him, I don't want to hear it. Mike Gminski won Defensive Player of the Year. I think other players that might have been in the conversation would have been Alton Lister and maybe Kevin McHale. I thought it was interesting that both of them wound up on the All-League second team defensive team. But Gminski was one of the best players in the league in rebounding, top of the league in blocks, managed to gather 0.8 steals, and that was better than what Liston and McHale did by double. He had more rebounds than both. Lister tied him for blocks, but more blocks than McHale. So, you know, again, can I really make an argument that either of those two players was a better defender than Gminski? Statistically, no, and I suspect that statistically it's rebounds, steals, and blocks is what that's looking at. And Gminski, you know, had one of the best seasons there. For the most, sixth man of the year, rather, Greg Ballard of the Clippers won it, averaging 13.2 points per game. Other players that I thought might have been able to win it but started too many games, about halfway through the season, maybe a little more than that, I moved James Worthy off the bench, or from the starting lineup to the bench, but he'd already played too many games as a starter and disqualified himself from being a sixth man. I also think on the Lakers, Jamal Wilkes is a guy that, you know, probably could have gotten serious consideration, but again, he started 54 games, so too many games started for him to really be in contention. Most of those were started prior to the Magic Johnson trade, after the Magic Johnson trade. You know, so he started the year as a sixth man, but got promoted once Kelly Trpucka moved out. How do I feel about that? You know, I don't know. I think it's probably better to have true sixth men. You know, I think the threshold is you had to play more games off the bench than you started. So theoretically, anyone that starts 41 games is disqualified for sure. I really would rather see the threshold be like 20 games. I don't really think, you know, James Worthy started like 50 games. Is he really a sixth man? Probably not. So if you're asking me who was a better sixth man than Greg Ballard, I haven't done a deep, deep dive into the league and into stats, but I don't have a complaint about it. Ballard on the Clippers was truly a sixth man, averaged a lot of time off the bench, But he certainly wasn't going to start at power forward ahead of Mike Mitchell, who, you know, really this season was a revelation, you know, averaged almost 30 points a game. He wasn't going to start as a big ahead of James Edwards, wasn't going to start as a forward ahead of Rod Higgins, who averaged 18. So, you know, legitimate off-the-bench player. I think it's fine that he won the award. I have no quibbles with the award. Danny Shays of the Supersonics wins Most Improved Player. And sometimes I think this award goes to a player not necessarily for improvement, but just for getting more playing time. I don't think that's the case with Danny, and here's why. Last season, he averaged 21.2 minutes per game and averaged just under 6 points a game. This year, he's averaging 32 minutes. So basically added 50% to his minutes. Well, if you add 50% to 6 points, that'd be 9 points a game. Shays didn't average 9 points a game. He averaged 16. So he almost doubled that. You know, his production was just way up from what it was the year before. And I think to me that speaks to, you know, an uptick in production speaks to player improvement. And, you know, if you look at his advanced metrics, you know, true shooting percentage rose from 52.9 to 63.4. Points per shot from 1.24 to 1.56. Usage rate went up from 14 to 19. Rebound rate went up a little bit from 13.2 to 14.3. His PER went up from 10.8 to 19, almost doubling. So do I have a problem with Danny Shays picking up the Most Improved Player of the Year? I don't. I, you know, maybe I could dig in and find another player that I could say, oh, this guy was better, but was Shays a bad choice? I don't think so. So let's turn our attention now to the all-league teams. You know, Larry Nance was the all-league center, averaging 29.6 and 8. Is there a guy out there that was better? When you account for scoring, probably not. Kaminsky, I think, is better defensively, but there's an 8-point difference per game in scoring. That's too big for everything else to pick up, especially because Nance was pretty good in block shots, better in assists, close in rebounding. You know, everything else pretty close to Kaminsky, and then offensively just much better. Magic Johnson, the MVP, nearly averages a triple-double. No problems with that as a first-team selection. Kevin McHale of the Bucks nearly averages a double-double in contention for Defensive Player of the Year honors. The only problem I have with that is he's on the Bucks. Hey, Doug, trade him to me. I love McHale. He'd fit right in with the elbow-to-the-head gangster Blazers. In the backcourt, Kiki Vandeweghe of the Jazz, 30 points, 6 rebounds, 4.2 assists, and a darn near 60-point triple-double in the playoffs. No problems there. Calvin Natt of the Kings. I think there you could maybe argue Sidney Moncrief is more deserving, but you know, then you look at Natt's rebounds and, yeah, okay, yeah, fine. Second team was Daryl Dawkins of the Nets. Again, good pick. Moses Malone of the Warriors. You might have been able to argue him over Kevin McHale on first team, but you know, I don't hate it. They're both pretty close. McHale edges him a little bit in scoring, rebounding, give the edge to Malone. Everything else is kind of a wash. McHale's a little better shot blocker. So, yeah, well, I can see Moses being second team. Bernard King of the Kings, also second team, averaging 29.7 boards, 4.5 assists. Yeah, again, do I have a complaint with it? No. Reggie Theus of the Clippers. Do I have a complaint with it? No. He's averaging a double-double, 10.5 assists, 20 points. I'm fine with Reggie Theus being on the second team. You could argue Sidney Moncrief should be ahead of him, but he's on the team with him, so it's fine. Am I going to put Maurice Cheeks ahead of him? No. Maurice has more assists, but way fewer points. Who else am I going to pick that's a guard that I could even, you know, say, yeah, this guy might be worth it? Clyde Drexler, still too raw, not there yet, doesn't pass enough. James Worthy playing out of position at guard, no, doesn't score as much. Rebounds a little better, doesn't pass as well. One of the things I think is interesting to look at is kind of the passing of the passing point guard. in the all-league teams. Third team, Gaminski. We talked about him for DPOY. I'm fine. Larry Bird on the Rockets. He's not as good as the other forwards. He's fine. Dominique Wilkins of the Supersonics, having a great scoring season. I've got no quibbles with that. Mo Cheeks of the Bulls and Ricky Green of the Sonics, high assist totals, scoring totals. I don't know. I think like Dennis Johnson probably missed this due to too many games injured. I wonder who else is out there that maybe deserves it a little more. I'm almost thinking, you know, going back to the David Thompson question with the Warriors, is 20 points per game good enough to make all-league third team? I don't know. Maybe. I'd entertain the argument, but I don't have anybody to look at and I say, oh my gosh, that guy should have made it. These are awful picks. I think if you like scoring, these are not your best picks, but overall, all-around play, I think it's fine. All-defense first team, we already talked about Gaminski. Magic of the Lakers. I have a little bit of a problem with that one. Yeah, he gets a lot of steals and a lot of rebounds, but I don't know. Magic feels like a guy that scores 30 and gives up 25. Terry Tyler of the Bucks, I get a guy who can get you both blocks and steals from the small forward position and rebounds, very valuable. Maurice Cheeks with the steals, okay, sure. James Worthy, I almost think he's on this list because he's a high rebounding guard, and I'm pretty sure defense looks at rebounds, steals, and blocks. And because he's playing enough at guard to be classified there, he gets picked. Would he make it over Magic or Terry if he was a forward? No. So I'm a little sanguine. I mean, I'll take it, but I'm a little sanguine on James Worthy as a first-team all-defensive player. Alton Lister and Kevin McHale's all-defense second team. Sure, I thought they could have made all-defensive team or defensive player of the year. Jim Paxson of the Cavaliers, that's probably fine. Lester Connor of the Trailblazers, got a lot of steals. What else did he do? Got benched halfway through the season. Not sure I agree with that one. And I know I'm bashing my own guys here, but it's true. I'm not sure I agree with that. I think there were guys that were better than Lester that were out there defensively. Michael Ray Richardson of the Pistons, sure, I don't have anybody to look at and go, yeah, this guy's better. Okay, now let's talk for a minute about the all-rookie teams. Ralph Sampson, absolutely. Clyde Drexler, averaging 18.1 points a game, 7 boards, 5 assists, 1.4 steals. Yes, he's a stud. He's going to be a stud. He's going to get better. Dale Ellis of the Nets, 15 points. He's going to get better, and he's on a team where they've already got Chocolate Thunder. All right. Daryl Walker of the Pacers. Do I have a better rookie? Not in the front court. Am I scared of Daryl Walker? No. Doc Rivers of the Mavericks. Yeah, he racked up a lot of assists. Am I thrilled with 12.4 points? No. It feels like this rookie class just isn't as productive as the last couple classes. Mark West of the Spurs, 8.8 rebounds. Roy Hinson of the Rockets, 9-4. Randy Brewer of the Jazz, 5.6 and 4.7. Byron Scott of the Spurs, 18.5. Fine. Jim Thomas of the Celtics, 12.3. I don't know. If our all rookie teams have, you know, 4, 5, 6 guys averaging less than 13 points a game, I feel like either these rookies are super raw or this was a down draft year. You know, obviously, Ralph Sampson's great. Drexler's great. I think Byron Scott looks good. Dale Ellis looks okay. All the rest of these rookies, I don't know. They're going to have to develop, and they're going to have to develop quick, and they're going to be overshadowed by the 84 draft class. So I think, you know, that's something that concerns me a little bit if I'm building young. The first couple draft classes were amazing. This one maybe hasn't been so. 84 is going to be great. Or 85, 86, 87, going to be guys that can turn you around real quick? I don't know that they are. So real quick, overreactions to the playoffs. I'm just going to give you very fast thoughts on this. Jazz, put up a valiant fight. Chambers is injured. Kiki's injured. Brewer's injured. Those are definitely their top two players and three of their probably top six players. The Jazz are cooked. The Lakers are moving on. Warriors are going to have to figure out a way to deal with Magic. Trailblazers and Sonics, both of these games were actually a lot closer than you think. The Sonics lost by 6 and 5. That's enough for them to flip on the road. I think this series, from the perspective of the Trailblazers, which I am, I really want to get one game in Seattle before Dennis Johnson comes back. I'm terrified of facing them if it's 2-2 and he's back. I don't want a best of three with DJ. So if the Trailblazers close it out, I think it'll be in 5. Otherwise, Sonics in 7. If you put a gun to my head, I'm going to say Blazers in 5, and I'm not going to like it. Then when they get matched up with the Kings again last season, if I remember correctly, we got swept by the Kings. Not looking forward to that matchup if we get there. If the Supersonics get there, they're going to have to deal with the Kings. Somebody's going to have to deal with the Kings. Darth, I think, is willing to spend more time on game planning than anybody else. I think I give him the edge in game planning. So given how close those teams are, I'd give the Kings the edge. I do think this season, if the Warriors are healthy, and I have no reason to believe they're not, I think the Parrish injury in Game 7 last year was huge. I think the Warriors move on. So I think the Warriors are going to come out of the West. I know, boring, chalk. The Bulls and the Pistons. The Bulls, I mentioned before, they kind of molded themselves into a contender. In Game 1, they spanked the Pistons by 30. In Game 2, it was a little closer. They only won by 6. But the Bulls are doing exactly what they wanted to do, and that is just come in and do shock and awe and have Tree Rollins try to shut down Terry Cummings a little bit. Has he done it perfectly? No. I expect the Bulls to move on out of this one. I'm going to see the Pistons taking a game, but give me Bulls in 5. When they match up against the Bullets, the Bullets have home court, but I've seen enough out of Logan to think that he's got something up his sleeve, and the Bullets this season just feel like they're stuck in the mud a little bit. Give me the Bulls to move on to the conference finals. Cavaliers and Nets. This one's a little bit of a surprise, although maybe not, because I think several people picked it in the town hall. They had an 8-point win and then another 8-point win, and that's on the road. They're going back home. I can see this turning into a sweep. This could be another year where Daryl Dawkins goes nuts, and somebody mentioned it in the chat. Herb Williams is having a coming out party this season. I kind of dogged him on an earlier pod, saying I thought maybe he should have been better in terms of production for where he was picked than he has been. He's proven me wrong this postseason. I guess we'll see if it keeps going. I think the Nets move on, and then they run into a buzzsaw that is the Bucks. I think the Bucks will gut the Nets when they get there just due to their defensive acumen. I think they have enough guys to slow down and Daryl Dawkins and just throw fouls at him and shot blockers at him. That'll take us to Bucks versus Bulls. Both teams are deep in the front court. Both kind of more defensively than offensively, except the Bucks have Kevin McHale. I think McHale's the difference. The Bucks get through. That takes us Bucks versus Warriors in the finals. Then it's really, do I like Malone better or McHale better? I've seen Malone chuck a couple times. Give me Kevin McHale. I'll take the Bucks. There you go. There's a quick overreaction of the playoffs. I'm going to wrap it up here. Maybe there's one more pod by the end of the postseason. I don't know. There's not really a lot else to say. You know, we're going into the draft. I think a lot of people know this draft. It's a famous draft. Not much to react to until we have the draft lottery and the draft order is known, unless there's some major injury or major upset in the playoffs to talk about. So we're probably good for this season. Again, last reminder, going to be a very expensive off season, and we're really going to start seeing teams grapple with the cap, not this coming season, but the season after that, I think. So A lot of adjustments coming in. You know, we've kind of had the training wheels on. The training wheels are starting to come off. And I am glad that we're past the 84 draft, because now I think we're going to see an uptick in teams trying to be competitive. No longer are you going to have 7 teams fighting for 6 playoff spots. And in the background, looming, maybe it comes sooner, but expansion may eventually show up. When we get close to expansion, we'll talk about expansion draft rules and what that means for your team. For now, just kind of keep in mind over the next couple of free agency seasons, usually what expansion means is you must expose at least one player to the expansion draft. And that means if, and you can only protect, I think, eight. So what that means is you need to identify not just your core of eight guys, but your core of nine guys, knowing that you're going to have to expose one to the draft. Right now it would be scheduled for 88. It might come sooner. And so that's going to put even more pressure on you cap-wise, but you don't need to start thinking of it now necessarily, but have it in the back of your mind so that when it comes, you're ready. And that's going to be it. Wig is out. Good luck to all the playoff teams except right now the Supersonics and anybody playing the Blazers at any point. Peace out.